Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Friday, August 20th, 1999. We're in the fireside room of Koinonia this morning. Your presenter is John Marty. Today's session number is 99-4, and the title is Capital and Cathedral, Making Connections Between Faith and Politics. Let's listen in.
Yes, Senator from Minnesota, and today's topic is, I titled it Capital and Cathedral. I was trying to be cute, but basically it's to be a conversation about connections between our faith and our political involvement. I'm going to start out with the premise, presumption, I guess I should say, that the reason you're here at Holden, the reason I'm here at Holden, or one of the reasons, and one of the reasons you're specifically here at this session is because you have religious faith, religious beliefs, and it's important to you. It's a 7-day-a-week thing. It's not something you do Sunday morning and then you, Luther said, sin boldly. I don't think he meant go to church on Sunday and then just do whatever you felt like the rest of the week. Your faith is supposed to involve every part of your life. And in a democracy like this, we are responsible for our government. We are the government, and it's not an optional thing. Certainly not everybody chooses to participate, but what they've basically chosen to do is say, I'm going to let the other folks decide what happens with their government, which is a choice that people are entitled to make, but it's a choice nonetheless. But if, as citizens, we are responsible for government, and as Christians, we believe our faith should influence everything we do in life, well, how do we connect our faith in politics? First thing, some people ask, well, what about the separation of church and state? And I'm a strong believer in the importance of our constitutional separation of church and state. It's a valuable protection for us against government that interferes in our religious matters, either by telling us this is what you must believe or prohibiting us from believing other things. Freedom of conscience is very important to us, and the wall of separation is very important. But the wall of separation is not to block people from having faith. It's not to block them from using their faith in making choices in how they raise their children or using it in their choices of how they run their government. We are going to be using something that affects us 24 hours a day in the decisions we have to make as citizens. So as we try and connect our faith and responsibilities, bus. You can tell there are lots of kids on that bus. As we try and connect our faith and our politics, I like to look for guidance to the prophet Micah chapter 6, where he says, what does the Lord require of us but that we seek justice, love kindness, and walk humbly with our God? And certainly loving kindness doesn't have anything directly to do with government, with politics. Walking humbly with our God, I think it's, those are things about us. But the justice part of it is something that we can't just do on our own. We can treat our neighbor justly, we can treat our friends justly, our kids justly. But part of seeking justice is to seek justice. The prophet doesn't say seek justice for your friends, seek justice for everyone. And each of us, how do we seek justice? Well, we're each called in various ways. Some of us is janitors, some of us around here is housekeepers and cooks and nuclear physicists and politicians and everything else. We are called to serve through different means. We are to work to seek injustice through our callings. And for the citizenship portion that all of us have, because we are all citizens, all responsible for our government, I tried to outline here some guidelines or ideas on how we might try and think through the connections between our faith and citizenship. And so what I'd like to do is spell out some of these guidelines and then spell out how I think they play out, some of the specific areas they may play out into politics, and then open it up for discussion, because this is the type of thing that I think a lot of you have lots of thoughts on, or maybe questions instead. But here's some of the guidelines. First of all, some of the, I would suggest, don't do things. The first is, don't use scripture to prove the merits of your position. Scripture's been used to argue for both sides of almost any kind of political position, especially ones people feel strongly about. 30 years ago, Jerry Falwell used to be out there arguing that the Bible talked about separation of the races, so he was pro-segregation, which was a very common political opinion to have in the South in those days. Liberty University that he heads is no longer segregated. It's an equal opportunity school. He no longer believes in separation of the races. Back then, he said, it's the Christian position to be pro-segregation because the Bible told him that, and that's what Jesus Christ wants. Well, 2,000 years after the birth of Christ, I don't think he went 1,960 years going one way and then he changed his mind. Jerry Falwell changed his mind. Jerry Falwell had new insights, new understandings of what things meant. And I think the trying to argue that Scripture proves that this is Christ's position is not a healthy way to do it, and it does lead, if you want to think over time, it should be somewhat embarrassing to him to think that one time he thought this and now God didn't change God's mind. Jerry Falwell changed his mind. The second one, and it's related to this, is to recognize that our positions are our positions, not God's positions. We're going to have disagreements over what our positions are. We're human beings, and we, as Lutherans, I know how much we disagree over what kind of liturgy to use, the kind of hymns we like to do, and I've seen churches that get torn to shreds over those things. So how much more are we going to disagree over our political position? And I like to remind people, I wish I had a newer example, but it's a almost 12-year-old, 11-year-old example now, but think back to the 1988 presidential campaign. There were two ordained ministers who were running for president that year. How many of you can think of both of them?
I
talked last night. Most of you can think of one or the other, because I think about half of you would think of one, half would think of the other. Pat Robertson and Jesse Jackson. They were both running. Both of them are not only ordained clergy, both of them are different brands of Baptists. And like Lutherans, they disagree with each other about religious matters as well. And both of them grew up in the South, both of them within a generation of each other. There's, I don't know, maybe 15, 20 years age difference between them. But even if they grew up in the same town, they would never have had much occasion to be around each other at the same age, simply because their backgrounds were much different. Jesse Jackson never knew who his father was. Pat Robertson's father was a military person and a U.S. senator. One was very rich, one was very poor. Probably the biggest single difference, one was black and one was white in the segregated South. And look at their experiences, look at their environment, and you're going to see how they might come to different conclusions on how the political world should respond to human need, how the political world should govern our country. And if we take them at what they say, they take their faith very seriously and they relate it to their political involvement. So we're gonna see disagreements. In that same campaign, Doonesbury had a lot of fun with the fact that Pat Robertson didn't quite use the word endorsed, but he sort of hinted that God was in behind his campaign, and Doonesbury had a great cartoon where it shows the lectern off one side at the press conference, and reporters are all talking to each other in the back of the room, and Pat Robertson is saying in so many words, yes, my campaign's been endorsed by Jesus Christ. And the reporter says to the next one over next to him, sure beats an endorsement from the Teamsters. And I think we recognize the fact that Doonesbury puts it in the humor, we recognize that there are lots of people who have a strong faith who come up to different conclusions, and I like the use of Pat Robertson, Jesse Jackson, because they are very far apart on the issues. They don't share a lot in common. And this gets back to the point, recognize that our positions are our positions, not God's. They're influenced by our faith, certainly, but then filtered through our educational background, through the environment we grew up in, through our experience. So how do we connect them if we're not supposed to claim God's positions, that our positions are God's, and use the Bible to prove our position? Well, I suggest we use our faith to help us understand, use Scripture to understand the direction, the goals, the values that Christ is teaching us. There's a big difference between understanding, getting an understanding that God wants us to care about others. God wants us to seek justice, from one of saying that, therefore, that means that we are supposed to support this platform plank of this political party and this particular candidate. That's where we use our human wisdom, or lack thereof, to try and do our best jobs in coming around to what we should support. I like former Lutheran Richard Neuhaus about 20 years ago, and I'll paraphrase it because the language is long outdated now, but he says, the Bible doesn't tell us whether to feed hungry children with food stamps or higher wages or with food shelves, but the Bible does tell us it's not acceptable to let children go hungry. So we can get a lot of guidance of what God wants us to do, and then we're supposed to use our own judgment, and that's where the political debate comes into place. We shouldn't be disagreeing about the importance of loving our neighbor as ourselves, of serving others. We should then go out and try and put it into place. And certainly, if you talk with people different parts of the political spectrum, this Richard Neuhaus quote, feeding hungry children, food stamps, government program, food shelves, private sector, charitable effort to do the same thing. Which is it? Well, I know some people, government shouldn't be involved in that, let's leave it to the charities. The charities once did it. Well, I'm not sure the charities ever fully did it, but they've tried and they still try. Government's never fully done it. And the one thing I guess I'd say is I don't care what your position is or what mine is, what we have, our way of solving the problem. The point is, we're not off the hook if our solution doesn't get there. If you say, well, it's not government's role, it's the food shelves' role to take care of hungry kids. Fine, if the food shelves take care of hungry kids, but the Bible isn't telling us, you know, you're supposed to take care of hungry kids. You come up with a theory, try and do it, and if it doesn't work, well, you did the best you could. You still have an obligation. If the food shelves don't do it, you've got to find a different way to get it done, or maybe all of the above as ways of doing it. The Bible tells us the goal, we're supposed to be the concern, the value, and then we are to find a way, whatever our political philosophy, we're supposed to find a way to carry out those values. Other parts of guidelines on how to connect our faith in politics. I use the term respect for others as an important one. Politics these days is more and more name-calling. One Minnesota political operative was quoted in the paper, which destroyed it. Lots of political consultants say the same sort of thing, but usually not in front of a reporter. But he told some bunch of candidates to, the best way to make sure they win is describe your opponents as the scum of the earth, and portray them, everything you do about them has to look nasty, and you try and make it look like you're not being nasty, but color what you say about them, you can kill them with kindness. This, my opponent is really a nice guy, but then twist it in such a way that makes them look really awful. A decade ago also, there was a group put out a morality ratings of members of Congress. It's okay to put out voting records, agriculture, labor, environmental, business groups, all. As a legislator, I got all kinds of voting records depending on the group. Some of them love you, some of them hate you, some of them are kind of in between. And that's going to be true, and those can be very useful. If you know a group that shares your concerns, if you're an environmentalist, you like the Sierra Club, and you like their positions, if somebody gets high ratings from them, that may make you think, hey, despite the fact that their opponent keeps talking about how they care about the environment. This person's got pretty high ratings. Maybe I should support them. So voting records can do good, but the nature of this one group, Christian Voice, did morality ratings of members of Congress. Of course, the implication by that is that the ones with low scores are immoral, and to which former U.S. Senator Paul Simon wrote a column once at that time saying how this group had, son of a Missouri Synod clergy, and I think everybody, both parties, thought he was a very decent, honorable guy. He got a 0% morality rating. And he pointed out in his column that Father Robert Drynan, the Catholic priest back then, he got a 0 rating. And Methodist minister from Pennsylvania got a 10% rating. And a Baptist minister from Alabama got a 0% rating. And then he pointed out one guy named Richard Kelly, who was a congressman from Florida, who got 100% rating, had just been convicted in the Abscam bribery scandal. And so we can make fun of their thing, but what they're basically trying to do by their terminology is to ridicule others, to belittle them, to put them down. And in politics, you can disagree with people, you can consider them honorable, or maybe you don't even consider them honorable, but you can treat them with respect and recognize their sincere differences of opinion, and maybe even very strongly felt differences of opinion. Next one is, I would say, next guideline to keep is seek to do what's right, not just what's legal. I think the current attitude, and this is not just a political attitude, but it seems to be something that colors everything we do in life, from business to media to our own lives. If it's not illegal, it's okay to do that. And the law has never been a determinant of what's right and wrong. It's a determinant of what's legal or illegal. That may be part of what's right and part of what's wrong. And we hope that they usually coincide with each other. But just because something's legal, I mean, for instance, with our highway laws, you know, you're not allowed to go over 65 or 70 miles an hour or 30 miles an hour in an area. That's what the law says. If you are in a race to get somebody to the hospital, an emergency and so on, you may break that law because you're seeking a higher good. Sometimes people break it because it's inconvenient, and that may be wrong. There's a reason for these laws, for safety. But there are lots of other things. You can, lots of things that you might be able to nail somebody on for reckless driving, but that really you couldn't. They weren't quite reckless, but they were cutting ahead in an empty lane and then cutting off a bunch of people who've been waiting in line for a long time. That's not illegal. It may not make it the right thing to do. As Christians, we're called to lead ethical lives, not just law-abiding lives. And I think there's even a time when, if there's clashes between ethics and the law, some people have chosen to respectfully disobey the law through civil disobedience and take the consequences. Civil disobedience, the way it was taught by Martin Luther King and others, did not mean breaking the law to make your point and then trying to get off the hook. And he spent a lot of time in jail, and he didn't try and flee. He didn't try other things. He protested, but he suffered the consequences of doing it to try and show how he thought the law was wrong and something he could not conform with. This warped ethic of if it's illegal, it's okay, as I say, has been carried out in many other areas. One of the pervades media and everything else. Jonathan Frericks the other day was talking about painting his house and listening to talk radio, which he described as hate radio. And you know, if you listen to some of the, I think he called it pouring acid on our decent society, you listen to some of the outrageous, hateful things that are said. There was a radio station in the Twin Cities last year that had made some fairly vicious remarks. A talk show host, one of the most popular, says something about our culture, one of the most popular talk show hosts, said some really vicious and insensitive things to people in the Hmong community. And when Hmong community and others started protesting, it was severe enough that several advertisers pulled their advertising from the program. And I honestly think in this case it wasn't a case of their thinking it was better for their business because the radio station kept slamming them on the air over and over in front of their listeners. The people who don't listen to the show would never have known what they sacrificed. But several businesses pulled their advertising from the program over it. And the station's response was, we have a constitutional right to do this. Matter of fact, it would be wrong of us to censor this guy on his show because the public wants it and he's got good ratings and he has a First Amendment right to say that. And I think they missed very much the difference between their legal rights and their responsibility and their what's right versus what's legally okay. And ethics does not mean allowing you to do something just because it's legal. And in campaigns, it does not mean allowing the ends to justify the means. So before opening it up for discussion, how do these guidelines play out in politics? The first thing I'd say on any citizen's agenda or any politician's agenda should be look out for others, not what's in it for me. How can I get the best tax advantage for myself instead of somebody else? But look out for the needs of others, particularly the vulnerable. You know, the economy is moving at record pace, and yet there are homeless people in Washington State here. We had, I think the staff coordinator, Stacy, the other night was talking about how she worked in a homeless shelter in Seattle and homeless shelter for people with AIDS, and she met a young couple who was delivering a baby. They were sleeping in the car for 2 months before they found the shelter there. And vulnerable people need our help. Does that mean we do it through government programs, through private charity, through a more just economic system? Our agenda has to be concerned about the vulnerable, the refugee, the sick. And we're supposed to use our politics, our political ability as citizens to try and address those. Again, not necessarily through government programs, but one way or another, you have to address it. You can't say, well, we'd like to do it this way, but let it go. The second thing I'd like to suggest in how this plays out, and this is not so much in the public policy aspect as the politics side of it, and that is to reject the winning at any cost, reject the negative campaigning. We know negative campaigns work. It's a little more sophisticated than just throw mud at your opponent nowadays, because that's backfired for a long time. If you get too nasty, people will throw it out. So you try and color it with humor. You try and color it with, my opponent's really a nice guy, but, or you, my opponent means well, but. You try and color it in such a way that doesn't look like you're being vicious to him, but you really are stabbing him in the back in a very effective way. And the political consultants, as I said, seem to try and find ways to play that margin real close, where you're really being vicious to them, but you don't look like you're being vicious. I argue you ought to reject simplistic campaigns. This is not just politicians and their campaigns. It's you, the voter, have an obligation to somebody you may agree with a little more on the issues, but you know they run a nasty cheap shot campaign. That ought to be a factor too. Otherwise, if we say, well, it doesn't matter what they do until they get elected, but I know once they're elected they'll do the right thing, you know, you can guarantee you're going to destroy the political process by doing that. And again, fair campaigns do run counter to what we know works best in the current system, but there are lots of people who run very fair and very honorable campaigns who do win races, and the only way we're going to get more of that is if we reward that and punish the other stuff. I'd say part of this, the fairness, seeking fairness in public policy and politics, is to reject the special interest money. I had a talk a couple of days ago about impact of special interest money on politics and how corrosive it is. And I think I mentioned how one of the authors of the McCain-Feingold bill, the Wisconsin Senator Russ Feingold, decided he was going to stick to his guns on the clean campaign, and he was going to reject the nasty stuff. He was going to reject the soft money, even though he doesn't pay for those. He argued against, and he got the people who were running stuff on his behalf to pull it. And he fought hard, and he was very vocal about that. He didn't take big money. He set a voluntary spending limit on himself, all those other things. And proponents of clean campaigns and rejecting special interest money all say, look, he won. And I take great pleasure at the fact he won, but he squeaked by with a couple percent when 3 months earlier he had a 20-point margin. The other guy, aside from where they stood on the two issues, on the other issues of things, the other guy just decided, well, you know, I'm going to use that money to get my point of view out, and he ran a tough campaign. I'm not going to say I'm a Wisconsinian, so I don't know all the details of how the campaign was run and so on, but I'm not going to say either side ran a negative campaign, but the one guy just had twice the money, and he just kept running tons of stuff against it, and it almost worked for him. You know, if his counterpart in McCain-Feingold is McCain, a Republican senator from Arizona, and you know, if those guys struggle because they try and limit the money they take and how they raise money, and we don't reward them, we're in effect guaranteeing that money is going to help take over the system more. So I'd argue rejecting the special interest money is a critical part of that. Then two more points. One is, I think we're supposed to use integrity and leadership in the process, and as politicians we should recognize leadership is not finding a parade and getting a flag and walking in the front of the parade. That's not leadership. That's trying to claim credit for where everybody's headed anyway. Leadership might more be seeing not what's popular but what you think is right and trying to turn the parade to go the direction it needs to go. And that's not always easy. It's not always popular, but politics and leadership is not supposed to be about popularity. It's supposed to be about trying to do the right thing. Working for justice may not always be popular, and just standing there and getting run over by the tank, as the young man did in Tiananmen Square, is leadership. It doesn't, he gave his life for doing so. He did not change necessarily the politics there, but if we don't have leaders who are willing to stand up to the wrong direction, we're never going to move the political system the way we feel it's appropriate to. And final point is, recognize the, people often talk, compromise is a dirty word. No, it's not. It's part of politics. Yes, it is. Compromise is not a dirty word if you're using it to compromise on public policy. I believe we need to move in this direction on health care, and anything we can move to get partway there. If I can get, can't get a full loaf, but I can get part of it, maybe I should settle for that. The trick is to get the best compromise you can. But there's a difference between compromising on public policy and compromising on your goals and your values. You should never compromise on your goals and values. If you get one slice out of the loaf you were trying to get, you don't say, oh, I did a good job, that's all I should do. You keep fighting for that goal. You don't ever give up on the value of the goal. You keep working for it. And none of this makes politics easy. None of it is guaranteed to win. And if you look in politics, I know as a candidate, the odds are against you. First time I ran, I had three opponents in our party's nomination process as opponents, and I had one opponent in the primary and one opponent in the general election. There were, I guess that makes about five people who were running against me, and only one of the five is going to win. And your odds are less than 50-50 in most races. If you count all the candidates who are running for president, there were probably 15 or 20 serious major party candidates. We know only one of them is going to win. And you're going to lose more often than you win in politics. I mean, we as a society have to recognize that each one of us can't win most of the time. And it's not going to be easy. And we who support a value, a goal of trying to serve others, which sometimes is out of fashion, out of political fashion, it doesn't make it easy. So we are going to struggle. And again, when the prophet Micah says, what does the Lord require of us but that we seek justice, love kindness, and walk humbly with our God? We are not called to win elections to succeed. We are called to seek justice. And we only fail when we don't try to do that. With that, I'd like to open it up for either questions or discussion, and I hope it stimulates some good conversation. Yes?
Can you tell us why you got involved in politics? What got you into the political arena?
Yes, and that's a good question to ask as part of this topic. When I was a child, my parents were involved in the civil rights movement, anti-poverty concerns, and you as a child learn very much. So your parents are your role models. And I remember when I was about eighth grade, we had two foreign students from Uganda living with us, and our school district was all white. We grew up near Cicero in Chicago, which Martin Luther King described as the most hateful community he saw. The racism was worse than the South. Anyway, we had a number of years where we weren't allowed to answer the phone because of hate calls. And you know, as a child, you see those things. As a young child, and when I was about six, we were at a conference. I think we were probably the only white family. It was our summer vacation in Virginia. And Martin Luther King was one of the speakers there, and he took each of us. Most of the participants did not have families with them. We were all traveling together, and he put us each as kids in this tree and played with us the way I like to play with little kids around here, and maybe it's from watching who you respect as the little kids, playing with little kids at a place like that. And we remember that, and why would I remember this one man putting me up in a tree when I was 6 years old? Well, Mom and Dad were telling us what a great man this was and how good of a person he was, and he lived that out in his personal life and how he treated us. And then 4 or 5 years later, when he was assassinated, my older brother said one of his friends at school, classmates at least at school, said he was glad they finally got that nigger when he was assassinated. And as a little kid, those things hit you pretty hard. You can see what you think is right and what you think is wrong. And kids can cut through a lot of the stuff we don't always see through as adults, put things in a different perspective. So I always wanted to work on issues like that, trying to change things. I was involved in student government in junior high, but that sort of lost interest. I mean, it was kind of a fun thing to do, but I wasn't involved in that in high school or anything. And after graduation from college, I thought somehow or another the political system. One time I wanted to be a minister because it was all the ministers who were involved in the Northerners who were involved in the civil rights movement were very heavily priests, nuns, clergy. I thought that's what I wanted to do, but I mean, that's not the fundamental purpose of being going into the ministry, is not for social justice changes. And I struggled with what I wanted to do, and it was some happenstance and a desire to get involved one way or another, and when a chance came to run for office, I gladly took it. I guess I remember in eighth grade civics thinking, oh yeah, I'd love to be involved in trying to change this, but I didn't know anybody in public office, and it seemed improbable, but I've had a long interest in it, but it was a concern for those things that somehow or another politics seemed to be the best one. And my dad and family have often said, well, I ran a race for governor unsuccessfully a few years ago, and well, maybe you should try doing something else. And I'd gladly switch to something else. I'm doing more and more writing, started a newsletter this year, all sorts of ways to try and change things that aren't just through the political process, but in many ways they all touch on it, because it's a powerful way to change things. I take one small issue, one last point on this. I take one small issue, the DWI issue. I've offered more than half of our new DWI laws as legislation in the past decade. some of the ideas 10 years ago, reducing the blood alcohol limit, which I think is important to do for the legal limit. Several years ago when I authored that, I couldn't even get a House author for the bill. Now I'm not even the main author of the bill anymore because it's just popular enough and I think it's going to pass soon. Some of the DWI laws I've looked at over the past 12 years, it saved a lot of lives in Minnesota. Nobody's going to know, I wasn't killed by a drunk driver because he wasn't on the road last night. You don't know that you weren't killed by one, but statistically you can see that the numbers have been falling 20, 30, more a year less. Where else can you have that kind of an impact? And I was going to say some people work very well one-on-one, some people work very well in bigger picture things, and I think I enjoy working in the big picture things. But that's a long answer to the question, but I think it relates.
Along that same line,
yes.
In South Dakota, there's a lot of Lutherans in South Dakota, but I don't have any numbers on this, but there's very few Lutheran politicians. And I just wonder if, did you feel, are you Lutheran?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Did you feel your church's theology encouraged you or discouraged you from political life?
I guess I'd say from, again, what, I wouldn't say by church either as the ELCA or my home congregation is encouraging or discouraging. People who know me and like what I stand for in the church are clearly glad you're doing this and we appreciate this and you work hard at this. And but I wouldn't say the church necessarily does. I would say there's something in Lutheran culture in North America that maybe it's a lot of Scandinavian heritage and other things that makes people somewhat shy and so on about, makes them more reserved as people and maybe less interested in getting involved. And certainly in upper Midwest, a lot of Scandinavians who, we don't talk about things like religion or politics or sex. Those are private matters and we don't want to do it. And therefore, sticking your neck out and running for office, you're forcing controversy. I mean, you go, the year before I ran for office, there was one of our neighbors who was trying to take a petition around to get the road repaved, get gutters put in, curbs put in. And friendly guy and so on. And a few months later, when I was running for office, my next door neighbor, an older woman, went around calling all her friends in the neighborhood and asking them if they would take my yard signs. This guy took one, and then later on when he found out I wasn't of his political persuasion, what's this guy doing in our neighborhood kind of thing. You can't, there are most people, even the neighbors who don't share political philosophy with me, they're still polite neighbors, they can still be friends, we just don't talk politics as much, but clearly it pushes something that we would never have to talk about if I wasn't in politics out there. And I think there's something about Lutherans that makes them shy about being involved, and I think nationally the number of Lutherans in politics is disproportionately small for it. I don't know, the way I see connections between faith and politics, I see it as a part of all of us as a citizen, as part of our calling to use our faith in our political involvement, whether that means just voting or whether it means more intense involvement. But the church itself did not, you should do this or you shouldn't do this. And you were saying you ran for school board, city council. A few years ago as clergy, and you had some interesting experiences with that. Maybe you have something to add to that too, to his question about Lutherans being...
I think that varies within our Lutheran tradition a lot because as to what a position a person takes. Nearly 40 years ago when I was growing up in Seattle, there was a Missouri Synod pastor who decided that he was going to no longer serve the parish, but he felt a call to go into politics because he felt his Christian and moral and ethical stance could be more, he could impact policy more highly by being a politician. Mm-hmm. Ran for governor of the state of Washington and almost beat a very strong candidate at that time. And then later on ran for senator and almost won there too. Neither time did he ever get into the position. But, and then one of my professors at seminary, J.V. Helberson, I know was very, his family, his dad was very active in South Dakota politics years and years ago. And but there's other people who, you know, feel just the opposite. Yeah. I think our church's stance on social issues is rather kind of evasive. And a lot of people say, why didn't the Lutheran Church take a stronger stand on this or that or the other thing? And they'll write study guides on different social issues, but will refuse to take a strong stand because mm-hmm. they realize that there's so many people of different...
So many strongly different things, and the Church's fundamental role is not as an organized body to support a particular candidate or a particular issue. Right, and so the church, but again, the church also feels called to seek justice, and how do we balance this? It's a fine line. And it's certainly not only the Lutheran Church that goes through this. I mean, we as a nation get uncomfortable when politicians too much about even their personal faith. Jimmy Carter, and until JFK, allowing a Catholic candidate for office. I mean, I think he very much put it to rest for that. If you have a Islamic candidate in most parts of the country, that person is going to be at a severe disadvantage. And again, churches, our church isn't so hierarchical as the Catholic Church, where priests and nuns are prohibited from involvement now. I mean, they have to, one of my colleagues is a former Catholic nun. She had to resign as a nun, run for office. I mentioned earlier Father Robert Drinan, who was a U.S. congressman from Massachusetts 20 years ago. He dropped out of politics when the Pope said, you have this choice. You cannot hold public office and be priest or nun. He dropped out of politics, and many others chose the same thing. And the one thing I've noticed in campaigning, and when I campaigned for statewide office, different churches, I mean, Lutheran churches, when I do adult forums, I feel very uncomfortable about, I don't see it as my job to be preaching from the pulpit as a state senator. Talking at an adult forum or discussing an issue, talking about this kind of topic or a specific issue, I don't have a problem with doing that, but preaching from the pulpit's a different nature of thing for me. But I notice in the African American churches in Minnesota, boy, it's a lot of fundamentalist Christian churches, a lot of black churches, you know, hey, it's just totally different culture in how they deal with it. And I mean, I think that's been true for a long time. Some churches stay out. A lot of fundamentalists until 30, 40 years ago had this strong belief we should shun politics, that we should stay away from politics and consciously stay out of it, some of them to the point of you shouldn't even bother to vote, or you shouldn't vote, because that's secular things. Then the fundamentalist part of the church got heavily involved in politics, and now I think 20 years later they're feeling maybe we overstepped some of that. But it's a struggle. I think Lutherans may be more reserved than some other denominations. Certainly they are about political involvement. Over there and then over here.
Well, John, I believe that as far as the church is concerned in politics as such, it is not a good idea, but the social issues need to be talked about and discussed. And as far as any part of that goes, we can draw a rather fine line. And I belong to some churches across the country where they won't bring up anything at all about politics, and I belong to some where the social issues are important. But I think the most important thing is, when I go to district meetings and so on as a PCO, I get really uptight when they tell me how I should vote just because I belong to one party. I split my vote, mm-hmm. and I said, I think maybe I better get out of the PCO business because I do that sort of thing, and I'm probably a heretic, and somebody else said, oh, that's okay, a lot of us split our vote. Yeah. So, but I don't want to be told, now yeah. I've got to support this this candidate just because he belongs to the party. He yeah. maybe doesn't exemplify the party.
And I think what you're saying about how you resent even your own party telling you vote for this person because it's a member of the party, I think it's even more so with the church doing so. And I think your point,
I'd like to know where yeah. they stand and tell right. me what, I mean, fill in the blanks that I haven't filled in, but I still need to make up my own mind, and I right. do that.
And I think that's one of the reasons the ELCA does more of the study guide approach to things, say here's values, here's concerns we as Lutherans hold. What does that mean about this? Should we do this? Should we? And a lot of questions, because first of all, we don't agree on them. But these are values, concerns we ought to take into our mind as we're trying to make decisions. And in terms of a church endorsing candidates and that sort of thing, I remember before I first ran for office, I kind of used to work at a hunger resource center for the Minnesota Council of Churches, and they were often looking for people to talk about hunger and poverty, and particularly around Thanksgiving time, a lot of churches and people are thinking about how thankful they are for what they have and what others do not have. And I remember I'd do some speaking on their behalf once, and I spoke at a church in one of the suburban communities in the Twin Cities, and I guess this was shortly before I was running for office, and the minister there said he knew of my interest in that. He asked if I knew Representative so-and-so, a guy who had just been defeated, happened to be a strong Catholic, had 11 kids, the whole bit. The guy had been defeated by a guy who decided he was the Christian candidate. And the minister said, well, several months ago in that race, the church was what you might call a good sign location. It was for lawn signs. It was two county roads in a fairly outer ring suburb. And he said one morning he came to church on weekday morning, came to church and saw some big political signs in the corner of the church lot for the candidate who was running against this incumbent Catholic legislator. I only mentioned Catholic because the other guy's comments. The other guy had his signs up there, so this guy looked at the bottom of the signs, got the guy's address, and he looked it up and called him and said, somebody put your political signs in our church property. And the guy said, well, I'm the Christian candidate. And as I mentioned, the other guy was a Catholic. Some might not consider that to be Christian, but I'm the Christian candidate. And the minister said, well, I'm sorry, but I don't care who you are, we don't take sides in these things, and we don't want your signs on our property. And they probably could have had some tax exemption questions if they had allowed them to be there anyhow, but we don't want your signs there. And the guy said, well, the churches haven't done enough for my campaign. That takes a lot of chutzpah to go up to a minister when you just put the signs in their yard. But he said he basically got the guy to take them down by telling him, if you don't come take them down, I'll take them down for you. But there are people who think because they have faith and because, and I'll give the guy credit for believing in something strongly. There are too many politicians who don't, but he was absolutely convinced that he was the Christian. He had the Christian perspective, regardless of who his opponent was, and therefore the churches owed him help for his campaign. And I think it's, I guess I'd say that, that's a credit to the ELCA that it tries to get us thinking about those issues, but and various churches do take stronger stands than others on various issues, but I think when you get people telling you to vote against or vote for somebody, I have real problems with that, and I think a lot of people do.
Apart from the religious mm-hmm. perspective of that, is there more nonpartisan positioning now than there used to be?
In the political world, I was going to say the political parties, there's so much, once upon a time, there was significant differences between the political parties. I think there still are some significant differences, but differences between members of each political party often exceed at least among elected officials of the two parties, often exceed the differences between the two parties, which may tend to temper what partisanship there is. But for instance, in the Minnesota legislature, I'd say there are definitely some differences between the two parties. There are also some differences between urban and rural, between this and that, and all kinds of other differences, philosophical differences, outweigh those of partisan differences nowadays. I don't know that it's getting less or more. It's hard for me to tell.
Just some of the things that you said, and it really struck me that the kinds of dilemmas that you as a politician have in terms of being a person of faith is similar to people that work in public jobs at wherever the level is. And that's that the concept of division of church and state within our culture is that you can't, in those situations where you are a public employee or a public public servant, you can't openly advocate or present reasoning for things that you do based upon your faith. And yet, as any position, whether you're an entrepreneur or working for a large company or whatever, as a person of faith, the core values and beliefs that you have are the basis upon which you make decisions. And I guess it, as a public employee and a person who's in a leadership position in there, I'm constantly faced with dilemmas that I can see as a politician. You're not only faced with those same dilemmas in terms of coming up with the concept of in a powerful position, but you have a microscope on you in terms of the public of a vast variety of people. And I mean, to me, that's a pretty the role of faith within our culture is real powerful, but it has to part of the church and state division is that the decisions that need to be made and the way that we make those decisions has to be private.
And in many ways, I was going to say, you have a tougher job as a public employee, public servant who is not elected but has a job to perform when you work in juvenile corrections, you've told me. In that area, you may be driven by something because of your beliefs, and you want to work with this young person in this way, and it would be so helpful to tell them, because of my faith in this, I believe we ought to blah, 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 because that may be how you come, a big part of how you make your decision. It'd be natural. So you may have a tougher time with that than the public official, because in our case, it's not so much what's the right thing to do, what can I do. To a certain extent, I have no problem with a politician saying, with a president or a governor or somebody saying, at a tragic moment, we keep, Clinton did with the JFK Jr.'s death, about how the nation keeps you in our prayers. I don't think we have to be secret about the fact that we have the beliefs and so on, but you're in a fine, difficult position because it's not your job to be proselytizing to the young people in there. And it's going to be a tension that's there for you and for me and for all of us, because clearly our faith colors who we are and how we decide things. I think you'd be a worse public servant if you didn't have the faith and didn't have the values that come from that. But I understand you've got to wrestle with that. We all do have to wrestle with that. In mine, if I make a choice, if I start saying, because the Bible tells me to do this, I should do such and such, and this state ought to do this, I'm going to suffer some political consequences if I get out of line there. You may not suffer consequences. You just have to try and balance. You may or may not suffer consequences. You have to try and balance.
Oh, I'd lose my job.
Yeah. If they know what you're doing, which I suppose they
know. If I were to openly, make a statement like that to a client, mm-hmm. directly to a client, and they,
your consequences are worse than ours, because chances are, in our case, some people say, "Oh, well, about time somebody told it the way it ought to be," or something. I mean, it's an interesting
Well, and the reason I bring that up is that that's the balance, particularly when you have the strong Christian movement that becomes the political movement that advocates this, and that's, at least in my mind, that's the balance that we have in this culture that we struggle with. But if you lose that balance on either side, either that you can't believe certain things or this is what you must believe, that's the balance that we have to fight against on either direction.
You're slipping off the horse on either side.
It's destructive of the things that...
And the courts have been wrestling with this for 200 years, and I'll guarantee 200 years from now they'll still be struggling with it. And I was going to say, some people who have condemned the courts as being really outrageous are convinced that the courts have said you can't have a faith and be a politician, you can't have a faith and do this, they always say, well, kids pray in public school all the time anyway before every test. Well, yeah, the Constitution doesn't prohibit that. I mean, it doesn't prohibit our private faith, it prohibits the school or the government in some way, the establishing of a faith, and I think that's you're right, it's a struggle that's going to be wrestled with for another 200 years in the background.
Do you find it disheartening, or do you find it recently, that there seems to be a lot more skepticism toward politicians and the fact that, you know, they may talk one thing but they do another? Have you found that on the increase, given everything that's gone on in the last 18 months, 2 years? And, you know, as a man of faith trying to do that, you must find that very disheartening or discouraging at times, because you're trying to, you know, some people are so skeptical right now about anything that politicians are saying.
I would say I'm not sure the last 18 months have been noticeably different to me. But I'd go further than your term on the skepticism, I'd say cynicism. Mm-hmm. I don't mind a skeptical public or a critical public. We're getting to the stage where we get to the cynicism that means I don't care anymore, it's so hopeless I don't even bother to vote. It's all corrupt, it's all whatever. That's very harmful, and I don't know that I'd say the last 18 months, but I'd say the last decade or two, and I'd say voter participation falling off is a good sign of that happening, and it is very disheartening. When I gave a talk on money and politics the other day, I talked about how I think it's extremely corrosive on our political system, extremely harmful, and it affects the entire political system. That doesn't mean everybody in politics are a bunch of crooks. I think to the contrary, I think the vast majority are honorable people trying to do a good job. But trying to get that distinction out to people when they're, it's all a hopeless, corrupt mess, is not an easy thing to do. And yes, it's very disheartening. And again, that's the Christian concept of hope. You don't always have to be optimistic things are going well, but we always have hope. We need hope. We have time for maybe two more. I'll do these two and then... Go ahead.
In Washington State, we have a part-time legislature. And I'm wondering if you have any thoughts on how that affects people's interest in politics. I sometimes get the impression that these people that take on these, what I think often are awesome responsibilities in politics, are totally overwhelmed. I don't know how they make a living when they're in a part-time circumstance.
Right. Our legislature is considered part-time as well. About one quarter are full-time, one quarter are, I say, truly part-time. They work 5 months of the year at this, and then they may check in with their office once a week kind of thing, but basically full-time farming or school teachers. We have a number of them now, attorneys, a lot of them always. It certainly brings a different perspective if it's not your full-time position and so on. But on the other hand, if people spent 20 hours, or if they spent 40 hours a week, 50, 60 hours a week studying issues and trying to do the right thing, we might have a better informed base of public officials. You can make the argument that they bring in more perspectives when they are truly the citizen farmer coming to the Capitol. My opponent once ran a campaign in which he talked about being a citizen. We need more citizen legislators. I think, what was he trying to say? That I was an illegal alien or something? I don't think the public caught what he was trying to say, but he was trying to say he was going to be very part-time at the thing, and He was one who would have needed a lot of time to learn about a lot of issues. I think you can make arguments in favor of it either way. I've kind of decided, you know, I'm going to spend the time I feel I need at the job, which is a lot more than a part-time position, but the pay is the same either way, and you learn to live with it. It's changing. I think more and more states are going full-time, and I think 20 years from now, just the complexity of all the issues is going to move it. One last one.
Yeah. Do you have any suggestions on what the church could do to counteract the cynicism towards politics?
The church as a whole, I think, can do much to, instead of bad-mouthing the system. I mean, I think it's when we were talking over here about where the church comes down on issues and on candidates and how involved should it be, there's absolutely no reason the church can't be talking about respect for, I mean, the church talks about respect for parents, respect for community, respect for others. Certainly part of that is respect for our society's civil structure, our governmental system. And the church teaching respect for people has to include government, and I think churches could do that. I don't have a lot of specific ideas on how, but the church is where we learn to trust and value and respect others, and we can learn to respect the diversity of opinion that we have, because I think you could take the people in this room or any room, take you and your spouse, you're going to take 100 issues, you'll find you disagree on a lot of them. And these are people you care about, and they still disagree, and the church can do a good job of teaching that respect and understanding of government. And the more we can promote that citizenship, that involvement, that patriotism, the more we can have a good discussion of the issues. And then we get to the political fight instead of the fight between I don't care people and let's change government. With that, I think our time is up. I'll be glad to stay around for a few minutes and talk further, but I hope this has stimulated some good thinking.